Welcome to Cross-Border Tax Talks, where we discuss the latest trends in international taxation, from macroeconomics to the latest developments on Pillar 2. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Global Leader. The Pillar 2 engine from PwC is a game changer for Pillar 2 modeling, provision, and compliance calculations. Built on a graph system utilizing over 20 years of international tax technology, this centralized rules engine is built by a team of Pillar 2 tax experts from around the globe. PwC's Pillar 2 engine is currently available as a service and will be licensable in July 2024. On this week's episode of Cross-Border Tax Talks, we're back in New York City at PwC's Policy on Demand studio, where I'm excited to have Anthony Ciara on the podcast. Anthony is PwC's Pillar 2 data strategy global leader and a partner in PwC's tax reporting and strategy practice based here in New York. Anthony, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Doug. Excited to be here.
So, Anthony, we've worked very closely together over the course of the last 18 months. We've had one of the directors from your team, Kate Miller, who was on the podcast talking about data strategy. I think it might be my top viewed Pillar 2 podcast that Kate did. So you've got very big shoes to fill, but I'm excited to finally have you on.
I'm excited to be here, and I have no doubt that I will not top Kate's performance, but I will certainly try.
Big shoes to fill indeed.
That's right.
All right, so before we dive into the material, we're recording this in early April. The Major League Baseball season has just begun. Listeners of this podcast and viewers of my YouTube channel know I'm a huge Cardinals fan. You're a big Mets guy.
Yankees guy. You already got it.
Yeah, you're a big Yankees guy. You went to Mets opening day, but you were envious of going to the Yankees game.
That's
so you're
right.
A big Yankees guy. A ton of history between the Cardinals and the Yankees.
Absolutely.
I can't tell you the countless World Series. The Cardinals, as you may know, actually have the second most number of World Series at 11 to the Yankees. Do you know how many World Series the Yankees have
27.
Won? Yeah, 27.
Yeah.
So we're a few behind. But
so I'm a traditional Yankee fan, so I don't know anything about any other team. All I care about is the Yankees.
I love it. So I get this question from a lot of our international listeners. Yep. Why do you like baseball? It seems so boring. But why, Anthony, do you love baseball?
Yeah, so baseball for me really epitomizes the old saying of America's pastime. So for me, being a Yankee fan is something that I grew up with, and still to this day, it crosses generations in my family. So my 93-year-old grandfather watches every Yankee game. He can't get out of his chair, but he watches every Yankee game, and that's a common bond that we have. We most of the time lately, it's been complaining about the team, but now it is. We're looking good this season, so it really is a multi-generational game for us in the U.S.
So, and we did not rehearse this at all, but like, I mean, I love the complexity of baseball, the specific athleticism that it takes, and the challenge of hitting a baseball. But it's the same with me. My grandfather, my mom's dad was a season ticket holder. My dad was my coach. He really taught me how to play the game. My mom taught me how to appreciate the game. So baseball's a family affair. So
it is.
I love
sure.
it. All right. Well, unfortunately, this is not a baseball podcast. You know, that might be in my post-retirement years, but we'll move back on to more important topics like Pillar 2. So really interested in getting your perspective on kind of where we are, kind of here as Q1 is coming to a close or is really, you know, almost beyond us by the time this thing published. So now that we're here in 2024. Pillar 2 is happening.
It is.
I still occasionally get the question. We've got 36 countries that aren't acting or haven't acted here in 2024. What are you seeing taxpayers and companies focus on when it comes to being ready for Pillar 2?
Yeah, so it is real, just to confirm for all of our listeners, it is real, and companies are starting to really execute on that. So for first quarter, the heavy focus is on just that, getting through the first quarter, ensuring that the appropriate top-up tax, if any, is embedded in the in your annualized rate. And then also, there are a number of actual ongoing conversations with auditors now. And those conversations are the beginning of the conversation, as most companies are not under a full audit for the first quarter. But the questions around how are you sourcing data? How are you executing the process? What's material to your profile? How much are you relying on the safe harbor versus running a full calculation? And how is that driving into your materiality assessment? That's where companies are focusing. The taxpayers we're working with are in a process of doing a robust documentation exercise for internal control purposes, and also having those conversations with the external auditor and their controllership function. Now, I will say that through that, what they're realizing is Q1 Q1 may be on us very quickly, but that analysis is expanding very quickly also because they're realizing the breadth of the exercise for the rest of the year and into the compliance season.
Yeah, and I mean, from my experiences, Anthony, I think that most taxpayers have been very focused on, particularly those public filers that you have to deal with Q1, where are what I refer to as the problem children?
That's right.
Where is their potential top-up tax? Do they operate in any low-tax jurisdictions? And obviously, getting a handle on what that number could be. But it's Q1, it's an estimate. There's still some practical elements that need to be done.
Of course.
I think the other thing is that many taxpayers, and we're going to come back to this, but I'll just introduce this as a teaser. There are a lot of taxpayers that understandably like, well, we're going to be able to meet the safe harbor. Yeah. We're operating in a high tax jurisdiction. And I think that the administrative guidance, we had Steve Cohart come on a few podcasts ago and talk about really some of the major changes from a country by country reporting perspective for what defines a qualifying country by country report for purposes of the safe harbor is really going to cause taxpayers to do some additional work here beyond Q1. But maybe before we double click on that, what is the approach that you're seeing taxpayers take as it relates to data specifically for Q1?
Yeah, and I think it goes to what you were just mentioning, Doug, which is identifying the quote unquote problem childs or the real areas of focus for an organization, and then translating that profile analysis into a data analysis. So fine, I've ruled out a bunch of countries because I feel confident in my safe harbor. Now I need to figure out for those countries that don't qualify for the safe harbor or don't meet any of the three tests in the safe harbor, how am I going to do that full calculation? Now, that doesn't mean, again, that it's full granular, detailed compliance level calculation. We're still in the provision, so there's going to be estimates. But what it does mean is going through the analysis, determining what's material, not only from a jurisdictional perspective, but also from an adjustment perspective, and then sourcing the data that's necessary for that. Now, in the provision, we all know you can't source all of the data that's necessary, particularly in Q1. So the other focus is on identifying proxy data that can be used to estimate a full year impact for those adjustments if we don't have a forecast, which is not new, right? We're doing that all the time now to develop the rate. We're doing it all the time for the full year provision even. That's why we have a return to provision concept.
I want to double click on that because I think we've got a lot of people who listen to this that are deep in the weeds in data, but there's a lot of technical folks.
Yeah.
And I'd love for you to explain that a little bit more because, frankly, as somebody who did a lot of advising and has kind of been later in the game over the last 6 years or so of my career doing a lot more of this quantitative stuff, the fact that the Q1, we're not going to have perfect data and we're making an estimate for purposes of the rest of the year, but I think your point is that there are other areas within tax that we have to go through a similar exercise. But maybe if you can unpack that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most organizations, most companies we work with, and that I came from industry, so even when I worked in industry, we didn't have perfect legal entity level forecasting, and we definitely did not have legal entity level forecasting on a statutory basis locally. And so what you have to do for many processes in the provision is find a proxy set of information, which is a good representative example of data that can be used for the full year calculation. And then from there, right, it's an estimate. You document why you think it's a good proxy of information, and you test it on a quarterly basis to see that it is. Now, what I'm seeing companies focus in on, which is slightly new for the Pillar 2 process, is we've got what I'll call discrete processes inside of the provision. Well, we take the proxy of information and we make an adjustment to it to approximate based on this year's facts. Maybe I've got a transaction, maybe I've got a divestiture, maybe I've got a strategic investment by the business in a new jurisdiction or a new transfer pricing flow that I need to adjust for. Well, I need to look at that from a Pillar 2 lens now, not just from a traditional four walls of a jurisdiction lens. And that's been a bit of a challenge for some companies because of the integrated calculation. I now need to do the estimate not only to my Pillar 2 calc, but also my guilty calc if I'm going to push down guilty into the calculation. So you can see how that cycle can get a little bit more complicated, but it still is the same old approach. If I don't have the data, I've got to come up with a reasonable approximation, whether that's last year's information or a proxy for this year's information, and run it through my calc and document why I thought it was good.
So what about beyond Q1?
Yeah.
And so we've got the companies that they've done a proxy, they've kind of working with their auditors. I think, all the auditors, all the big attest firms kind of getting their legs underneath them. And
absolutely,
this is obviously very bespoke to each respective client or each respective taxpayer with respect to what's actually material. And I mean, just there's so much uncertainty and complexity associated with this. What about beyond Q1? And what are taxpayers and what should taxpayers be doing that now that Q1 may be behind them or close to behind them, what do we need to be thinking about for the rest of the year?
Yeah, so going back to what I was saying, one thing is to test the assumptions that were made in the Q1 process. Are those going to hold for the whole year? Do I need to get more granular of a calculation? If I do, how am I going to get data to do that? Who in the controllership and finance organization do I need to start working with to blow out that data set to be able to do it? In addition to that, I think, as you mentioned, the attest firms are getting their feet underneath them. They're also getting their feet underneath them with the particular profile of the company. So what they're looking at in Q1 is most likely going to set off a couple light bulbs that come Q3 in particular and come Q4, even for some hard or soft closes, 11-month closes. We're going to start asking more detailed questions on certain things. And so what a lot of companies are doing is they're going to live with their quarterly provision process through Q3, but in parallel to that, starting to develop that full-blown, more robust process to be used on the actuals in Q4. The other reason that's really important is not only do we need to focus on the GAAP provision, but we know that what happens in the GAAP provision is going to get adjusted to get into the local stat provisions. And that is something that for most companies that are calculating Pillar 2 from the center is going to be a new process to push out information into those local stat provisions.
And I've seen this movie before, Anthony, as you well know, with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act with GILTI, which was really, and I like to remind folks that was the first income inclusion rule. You can listen to my podcast with Pascal, who, you know, sort of pointed at the U.S. for the first income inclusion rule being GILTI. And I think what you described is very similar what we saw with taxpayers getting ready for GILTI, doing those estimates for Q1, for Q3. And then when Q4 came, there needed to be a lot more process and diligence. And that was a single country IIR based on a blended tax regime. So it didn't need to be done by country. I mean, Pillar 2 is exponentially more complicated than GILTI. And one piece of advice that I would give to listeners and the listeners from the U.S. hopefully remember pushing too much of that off to Q4 to try to get to that robust data and the actual calculation that you're going to need for your year-end financial statements requires a lot more work. And I would encourage folks to start early because we saw a lot of U.S. taxpayers that really put that off to Q4. And then January was a massive fire drill.
Yeah. And I think the other thing to keep in mind is this such a heavy data exercise and there's so much reliance on non-tax teams. And so a couple things there. What we see at companies is the financial close is shrinking, right? So more of that close is actually being pushed into December. So whether it's cut off for expense processing earlier or even IT systems being shut down to any changes even earlier into November at this point for some companies. So in tax, we can't come back from Thanksgiving and start asking for new things. We're not going to get it this year. And getting into January, you're not going to get it either. And at year end, we're still going to have some estimates, but they can't be as high level as they are in Q1. So the work really does need to start now.
So one thing I wanted to discuss as you know, from your experience thinking about process is now this new transitional safe harbor rule with the December administrative guidance where, and I'm oversimplifying, but generally now for a country by country report to be qualifying to rely on for the transitional safe harbor, you pretty much have to exactly follow what's in your books. And so, you know, we had Cohort on, as I mentioned, on a prior podcast, talking about really what that means, but post-period transfer pricing adjustments, some of those topside entries that may get pushed down for country by country, you know, that would effectively disqualify a country by country report from meeting one of the transitional safe harbors. We have a lot of taxpayers that are out there saying, oh, we're going to meet the transitional safe harbor.
We're safe.
And then, you know, it just then begs the question of, well, what is your country by country report? Talk a little bit about that process, because from my experience talking to taxpayers that, you know, historically, obviously, the country by country report did not create or cause any taxable income. It was an informational return. Yep. It was something done well after year end. So you talked about the process that taxpayers are going to need to go through to get that data for the full globe calculations. It's a whole separate process now for country by country, but maybe talk a little bit about that.
It is, and the timing is one aspect of it, but also the process to get the information and an understanding of what is actually in your books on a more granular basis than potentially you've historically had to do. And just the reason for that is when I do the U.S. GAAP tax provision, It's just that. I'm providing an estimate for something. So if there's something off in the books, which doesn't matter for the GAAP consolidation, but matters for me in tax, I have an opportunity to adjust that through my return process. For purposes of the safe harbor test, you're not going to have an opportunity to adjust that. You need to, as you said, take what's in your books. So if something gets booked topside, if something gets booked, a transaction just gets netted or shortcutted in consolidation, you need to take that. What companies are focused on right now is, I want to know about that before the year end closes, because if that accidentally throws me out of the safe harbor, right, I want to go to the controllership organization in accounting policy and get that fixed in my books. I can't adjust it after. So the process, even for the safe harbor calculation, has to start before the year end closes, not after the year end closes. And again, like many companies, nobody's making adjustments, sizable ones in particular, in December. You're going to have to get to that early on in the fall to have those conversations. It's of particular importance with transactions. So highly transactional companies, particularly those that have internal restructurings, that is something that really going to want to focus on. And then the other thing I'll point out about the safe harbor is it's based on your CBCR report. There's also the competing or complementary challenge, if you will, of public CBCR. So we're no longer just looking at the CBCR report as an internal document. We're now looking at it as the basis to eliminate certain calculations or compliance obligations, and also something that has potentially going to be public for a number of companies.
Yeah, one of the comments that I know has been out there in the public domain is that, well, if you don't incorporate any some of these topside adjustments or even post-period transfer pricing, like how accurate or how reflective is really that country by country report going to be of the amount of income and or tax you're paying in that particular country? And I think I don't have a good answer to that question.
Right, but as Steve mentioned on the previous podcast, the guidance doesn't really care, right? It's not about getting to a closer approximation of local tax returns. It's about getting to a reasonable basis of calculation as an estimate for the safe harbor, for the globe calculation. So it's a slightly different approach to it. So aligning those is really important.
Yeah, one sort of practical point that I would suggest for listeners, just particularly as we think about the post-period transfer pricing adjustments, the topside entries, is I would encourage taxpayers to go back to the prior year and look to see what was the amount sitting in your books versus what was the amount on your country by country report. What's the delta between that? Because the point I just want to make sure that we emphasize is that some of those adjustments, whether they're TP adjustments, purchase accounting, whatever, can be big enough to throw a particular jurisdiction out of the safe harbor.
That's right.
Even in a high tax jurisdiction. And I think that's what could surprise some listeners is like, you do that math, like, wait a minute, you know, this X jurisdiction has a 28% rate.
Right.
There's, you know, there's really no major adjustments that they would have thought that would have caused that to be low tax for Pillar 2 purposes.
Yeah.
Just the fact that you're doing something topside and then pushing it down could have a major influence on that.
Absolutely. And once you're out, you're out. So, you know, do you want to get it right this year?
Right. And so I think that's just that, to your point on the timing, the process. One of the other things that I'm interested in your views on this, because I was talking to, I've had a couple of taxpayers that have said that, you know, the safe harbor is really no longer a safe. Like it's hard to call it a safe harbor, given that we need to change the entire process for how we do these country by country reports. And there have been a couple of taxpayers that are out there like, forget it. Let's just, this is transitional anyway. This is a 3-year safe harbor. Should we just, if we're going to put in the process and we're going to unpack what that process and technology means, should we just forget the safe harbor and just do the full globe calc and get us ready for the future?
Yeah. And my perspective on that is, in short, no, you shouldn't forget it, but you should do it in parallel to the full calculation. Yeah, there's also a sensitivity point around the safe harbor. If I'm going through my provision, I'm relying on the safe harbor, I would want to know in those jurisdictions where I'm relatively close, what happens if I get kicked out? What happens under that full calculation? Because remember, I could get kicked out of the safe harbor and still not have a top-up tax because of the way that the globe adjustments can drive and the covered tax adjustments. So I want to see it in both directions. And as I'm talking to companies about technology, one of the things that we're talking to them about is, I want to build an enabling technology platform that includes a calculation engine that can do both the safe harbor and the full calculation at the same time, including the QDMTTs and the DMTTs, because I need to get my guilty pushed down as well. And that impact on the full calculation could also drive a real difference between the safe harbor calc.
Yeah, and the point I think I take away from that, Anthony, is that ideally, you need to set up a process to do both of these calculations to be able to compare. And I think the concern or the challenge for some taxpayers is they want to focus just on the transitional safe harbors, maybe try to pull and put in the process for the full globe income in those jurisdictions that maybe have below a statutory rate of 15, Ireland, for example. And we'll just do globe for this and we'll do the transitional safe harbors. But again, that could come with some risk, and important to try to do both of those if at all possible.
Yeah.
So kind of along the lines of the data readiness, one of the things that, and you helped author, and we've spent a lot of time on this over the course of the last couple of years that we've been working on, PwC put out in March 2024, our most recent version of our data input catalog, where we've really tried to highlight for taxpayers, it's available on the web, we'll include it in the show notes, of all of the various data points. And I think we're at like 270 or 280 data points per constituent entity.
Yep.
We've updated it for the latest administrative guidance. From your experiences working with a number of taxpayers, get the question a lot, how much of this information is in an ERP system? If it's not in an ERP, where else is it? Is it in your provision system? Is it in a consolidation? Is there stuff at a system? Kind of as we start thinking about how we pull these pieces together, just where are we seeing this data sit generally within an organization? Yeah.
So we've been doing these detailed data mapping exercises going all the way back to March of 2020 on the original model rule set. And what I mean by doing the mapping is actually in company environments sourcing the data. What we've found, and we've done almost 100 of them at this point for large multinational organizations, what we have found is about 50% of the data is going to be sourced out of your trial balance. That could be in your ERP or your consolidation system, depending on how they're mapped and how they're configured. Or your consolidation system, depending on how it's mapped and configured. About 30% of the information is going to come from your actual tax provision process. A lot of that should come out of a tax provision software if you have it. A lot of it will come out of your work papers, which may or may not be in the tax provision software. And then the remaining 20% is what I'll call non-financial or non-structured data. So I think about some of the HR-related data that I need for the substance-based income exclusion, mm-hmm. or I'm always going to have some version of manual data collection for some of the nuanced information that I need related to transactions or restructurings or ad hoc intercompany transactions and things of that nature. So really, I'm looking at I can get half of it out of my ERP and or consolidation system, 30% out of my provision process and technology, 20% out of sort of non-systematized or sub-ledger type of systems.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of information that just maybe it's not out there analysis that hasn't been done, like on the deferred tax liabilities, whether there's going to flip within 5 years.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the overall process, kind of maybe at a granular level, and then what are technology solutions or what are things that taxpayers can do to help streamline that process? But really, we talked about where we source the data, mm-hmm. but that's just finding what information,
that's right.
and then we've got to transform it. But talk a little bit about that process and then how technology can play a role in that.
Yeah, one of the things, once I've identified where I can get the data, then I need to go through an exercise of mapping or labeling that data to the appropriate elements of the calculation. And that's not going to be a one-to-one mapping. I'm not going to take one account out of my trial balance and drive it into one adjustment. In all likelihood, I'm going to have 3 or 4 accounts coming out of an ERP, or I might have one account from 5 different ERP instances because of the way that my infrastructure is set up. And I've got to consolidate and transform that data to map it to what is effectively a Pillar 2 chart of accounts. Very similar to our US compliance processes today or my local compliance processes, just unique to Pillar 2. Now, once I'm able to do that mapping, then I've got to go out and collect that data. The biggest challenge on collecting the data and transforming the data for Pillar 2 is I'm going to get it from a disparate number of sources, each of which was not configured or stood up to talk to each other. So some of us are experiencing that if we have multiple ERP instances. But now think about the fact that I'm going to get data out of my ERP, I'm going to get data out of my provision, and I'm going to get data out of an HR system. Well, I have to line up the entity name at the first blush. Do I have the same entities in each of the systems? Then I need to start lining up jurisdictions. I need to look at, do I have a permanent establishment? Do I have a branch?
It may not be an entity.
It may not be an entity. Right. It may be buried in a parent entity, right? I've got to go through that granular analysis. Then once I've done that, I've got to actually collect the data, transform it into a common data model for Pillar 2, and get it into a calculation engine. Inside of that transformation itself, there are positions to be taken. The rules are not 100% clear in every jurisdiction, right. And there's opportunity for taxpayers to look at the rules and decide how they apply to my company, right? But I've got to do that on a very granular basis, and then I get it in the calculation, whatever the calculation engine is. I'm running that calculation, and this is an iterative process. Now, the one thing on the back end of the calculation, which we're still working on, everybody is how do I get that out into the downstream processes? I can get the top-up tax out. That's easy, right? It's basically a number. I'm going to put it in whatever jurisdiction I need to in the provision. But I got to get that data out into the forms. We don't know what the forms look like yet. I've got to get that data out into the local statutory provision. Because remember, inherently, right. Even though it's a global calculation, it's a local tax. I need to get it into my local statutory financials, the materiality for which is very different than the U.S. GAAP consolidated or IFRS consolidated materiality.
And as we think about kind of moving back to the earlier part of that process, as the companies kind of gather that data, talk a little bit about data infrastructure.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a number of technologies out there, obviously yeah. Some of the big ERP providers. I mean, there's lots of, frankly, PwC Alliance partners yeah. Where, you know, companies can choose to do it kind of behind their own firewall. I think most of these are on the cloud at this point, or, you know, they can look to a service provider to be able to do that. But talk a little bit about that choice and, you know, what's important for companies to think about keeping, you know, as they think about their data infrastructure, and then we'll talk about the compliance and the calculation engine.
So I think there's a couple key threshold decisions to be made. Number one, am I going to solve this data problem solely for the purposes of Pillar 2? A lot of the data, as I mentioned, is foundational data. I use it for other tax processes. So am I going to attack this for purposes of Pillar 2? If the answer is yes, I'm just focused on Pillar 2, well, then I need to make the second decision, which is, do I want to manage the Pillar 2 data inside my own infrastructure, or do I want to effectively pay a service provider to manage that data for me? Companies are split on that. Right? If I'm solving for this particular issue, maybe I don't need the full robust data ever for my provision process. I'm going to need it for the compliance process, but I don't want to invest in that infrastructure if I'm just going to be for compliance. I don't do my own compliance anyway. Let me push it to the service provider. If you choose to manage it internally, and if you're looking at it as multi-use data, then the question is, how do I collect that data and store that data? What is my technology infrastructure to do that? If I've got a lot of underlying ERPs, which a lot of companies do, mm-hmm. I can't rely on the data just sitting in the ERP. I've got to pull it out. I've got to normalize it. I've got to put it somewhere so then I can use it. Companies are looking at their data warehouses. That could be finance data warehouses, or what we've been doing a lot of work with is companies actually leveraging enterprise data warehouses that are being used by analytics and data science teams, front office sort of revenue supporting teams who have the data infrastructure on a granular basis. So can I use that? Can I create a tax view into that? Do I need my own tax data infrastructure, right? What is the cloud service provider that my company is using? Can I leverage that existing relationship? The other thing that we're working with companies on is, has anybody built the pipes already to my underlying systems, right? Has my internal audit team implemented automated controls monitoring? Have they already built the pipes? Mm. Has my enterprise data management team built the pipes? My consolidation system, you know, there's a couple key consolidation systems. Most of those systems have built the pipes to extract the data out of the ERP, but they've transformed it for purposes of consolidation. Can I undercut that and get the data before it's been transformed and take the raw granular data? And The overarching point for companies that are building internally is they're looking at their existing technology infrastructure, the existing investments that they've made in technology for non-tax purposes, mm-hmm. and leveraging those for Pillar 2, and then identifying opportunities to go broader.
Yeah, so you started with the companies that are trying to solve for Pillar 2. What do you say about those taxpayers that are actually in the process of doing a larger ERP implementation? To your point, there's lots of multinationals out there that have disparate ERP systems that are or maybe migrating to the cloud or looking for one single kind of source of truth, so to speak. And so obviously Pillar 2 just becomes one component of that larger piece.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple key considerations when you're looking at an ERP implementation for, and you're embedding Pillar 2 requirements. One is the entity structure in your ERP. The constituent entity definition is different than legal entity. It's going to be different than ledger entity.
Right.
And that lens is really important. In addition to that, there's chart of accounts considerations. So not only do you really need additional accounts to record the Pillar 2 taxes, you also need to be able to identify in your chart of accounts whether you've got a qualified domestic minimum tax or it's just underlying local provision, because I need to be able to identify that so I can determine whether or not I push the guilty down on it. So it's requirements that are new because of the new taxes. It's also requirements that are new because of the new data requirements.
So one of the things that we've obviously been working on is that process for those clients that don't want to do this in-house. And the process of creating a questionnaire and the process of transforming that data. Talk a little bit about kind of your approach to that.
Yeah.
You've been, you know, really leading the charge of that on a global perspective. And how have you been thinking about that, and particularly the experience for a taxpayer?
Yeah, so what we're focused on is creating what we'll call a global approach that then gets refined through a series of filtering questions down to the entity level. And what that will enable is an organization to take a standard approach to make 80% of the decisions at the global level, but still have the flexibility to be able to adjust for certain instances that are locally specific. What we're also doing is creating an infrastructure that allows you to trace those decisions year over year. So from a centralized provision or centralized calculation perspective, if a local controller tells me that, no, I didn't have any purchase accounting adjustments this year, and I know there's a transaction, and they look at that rolled over questionnaire and they don't check that the next year, I know that's a flag. I'm going to go back to that controller and ask. And so what we're trying to do is create this consistent, auditable, year-over-year experience for companies to operate in so that there's no question on the mapping or the data sourcing, and instead the review goes to the calculation results, not to the data. One of the key challenges in Pillar 2 is this environment is super dynamic. So I can create a questionnaire today that's very relevant for the data input catalog that we just released. Well, guess what? Next month, I'm going to have new rules, and I've got to update the data input catalog. I've got to update the questionnaire. I've got to update the mapping because I need to get it into the updated calculation. And when companies are considering whether they're going to do this internally or externally, that maintenance is one of the key considerations, because having to do that on a constant basis internally is going to be a real resource drain for a lot of companies. Not to say that you can't. We do see companies doing it, and it's a very valid approach. You just have to consider the resource of maintenance as much as the stand-up.
Yeah, and I don't know if anybody from the OECD listens to this. I certainly hope so. But I do want to just, you know, click on or mention the fact that as these rules change, the data sources change. And there is no magic pipe, as we've discussed before, as we talked when I had Kate on. There's no magic pipe we plug in. And so as these rules change and as the data sources change, you have to go all the way back to the beginning of the process to figure out what needs to change to accommodate that. The other big challenge, and we're going to talk about this in the context of the calculation engine, but I think, Anthony, this is just a really important point on the data, because well, how the calculation works is driven by what data goes in there. And as the calculation changes, the data can change as well. And there could be, depending on the jurisdiction and where they are as part of their legislative enactment process, there may be different data requirements for different jurisdictions and for different territories. And that's a real challenge, right? And it, particularly as we know we're going to get some additional guidance here in the coming weeks, if not months, on Pillar 2, that there are a number of countries that are not going to be able to enact that for 2024 because of their constitution or legislative process or whatever the situation may be. And that is going to create additional complexity for taxpayers that want to try to do that data sourcing internally. They're going to be working, whether they're doing the calculations themselves or using a third-party provider, the data requirements are going to change and their process is going to have to change.
Yeah, and I expect those changes to roll out for the next 3 to 5 years, honestly, because
I'm not sure it'll stop.
Yeah, I mean, not only do we have the legislative environment, but we also then have the audit and judicial environment that we're going to experience over time. And as we know in tax, everything's ever changing, right? It's job security, death and taxes, but it is something to really consider. The other point I make about the data complexity here is, because this is a global calculation, but inherently a local tax, as the local jurisdictions adopt, you could end up very realistically in a situation where I need two different sets of data or slightly different sets of data to do a calculation on the same jurisdiction. So if I've got split ownership, right, and two different IAR jurisdictions that are slightly different, well, I've got to do that calculation for both of those jurisdictions right. with that underlying activity. And if I've got a different data set, well, then I need to source the data for the lowest common denominator and push that data to the right calculation. And so that's something that a lot of companies are starting to realize, particularly those that have heavy, you know, split ownership structures or joint ventures. So it's a real complex issue.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a great example. I mean, even a probably overly simplified example is just a number of QDMTT jurisdictions or jurisdictions that have implemented QDMT are allowing taxpayers to use local staff, yeah. right, as opposed to the financial accounting standard of the ultimate parent entity. Now, like the UK, for their QDMTT, is using the financial accounting standard of the ultimate parent entity. But point being, there will be disparate data sets
Absolutely.
That are potentially required. And the other thing, because I do want to talk about compliance, just to mention, is that the trend that we're certainly seeing is a centralized approach to the Pillar 2 calculations. Yeah. And I've talked about this with Shin from Japan and others where that have historically taken a decentralized mm-hmm. approach, that I think what we're really seeing across the globe is a much more standardized, centralized approach to Pillar 2. Obviously, you need to work with those local controllers and finance folks to be able to get the data. But given how all these rules interact, particularly the QDMTT, how it impacts potentially your covered taxes, is it qualified, and
yeah.
how it impacts the potential safe harbor, that having that centralized approach, both from a calculation and data perspective, is very important.
It is really important. And it's really important to establish that early on. And even if you have different variations of the centralization through the provision and the compliance process, establishing roles and responsibilities is going to be really important. When you think about it from a compliance perspective, it becomes even more important because today, local country compliance, right, if you think about how it's prepared, it's very much, even if there's some central data collection, is very much a local calculation because for most countries, it's based on the activities that happen within the jurisdictional boundaries. The effect of that is I've got local officers of that company filing those returns, and they're doing so based on information and a structure that they understand. And they're filing under penalties of perjury in a lot of these jurisdictions
right.
with personal liability and personal criminal liability in some jurisdictions. So when you think about it from a centralized compliance approach, I'm sitting in a headquarters, I'm going to push data into a local return. I need to have a process by which I can get that local officer comfortable that I've got the right data driving into that return that they're signing with personal liability. That is very different than how most people are operating today.
Absolutely.
And that is not something I want to wait until 2026 to figure out how to do.
Yeah. And in fact, so let's move to kind of the compliance here for our last leg, that we don't really know exactly what the
right.
compliance process. We've got this global information return. We know that's going to be due as no earlier than 2026. But these qualified domestic minimum top-up taxes, that's really where we're going to see kind of that local corporate return. We haven't seen anything from the OECD insofar as what that form should look like. I'm guessing each jurisdiction will kind of have the opportunity to develop their own form.
Sure.
There's also not really certainty with respect to when those forms are going to be due. We know at least one jurisdiction, Belgium, I believe, have said that their QDMTT form is actually going to be due in 2025.
Yep.
I think Canada's legislation, I was just looking at that, I think their QDMTT form will be due in 2026, the same as the Globe Information Return. But a lot of uncertainty with respect to just what are these forms going to look like? What is the process? And I know service providers have been getting requests for a proposal
Absolutely,
for Pillar
yeah.
2 compliance. And there's just a lot of caveats because we don't know exactly what this is going to look like. But what are you seeing for taxpayers as they get ready and start to think about compliance? Or are most taxpayers saying, well, it's 2026, so we've got years for this?
I think up until recent weeks, most taxpayers have been saying, I'm going to wait and figure this out. What they're realizing as they're executing the provision is this is a bit more complex than they thought, and it also requires a lot more local coordination. The other thing that companies are starting to realize is their existing compliance operating model may not be fit for purpose under Pillar 2. So a lot of companies operate in a decentralized local compliance process. You know, they have the local finance teams that have the relationship with the local firm, maybe Big Four, maybe a local mom and pop shop. They file the local return, no problem, it's all set. That's going to be really challenging to execute in a Pillar 2 world when I've got a central set of data that drives all of the calculations. And a lot of companies are thinking, I don't want to be pushing data out to 25 different service providers. So maybe now is the time to revisit my operating model for compliance. Should I centralize it? Should I bring it all under one roof? Can I leverage data once? Now, that's a complicated conversation because a lot of tax departments don't control those budgets either. So that's a cross-functional decision with controllership and local finance.
Yeah, another important piece related to as we think about compliance, and we mentioned this earlier, is the country-by-country report for the transitional safe harbor. And so if companies think that they're going to be able to rely on the safe harbor for purposes of their compliance for that any particular jurisdiction, you better make sure you don't have one of those topside entries, because you mentioned this earlier, but it's worth mentioning again, once out, always out. So if you've got some sort of accounting anomaly or just process issue that kicks you out, then you're out going forward and you're going to have to do the full globe calculation from a compliance perspective. So it's important not to put that off too far, to make sure that if you are going to meet the safe harbors to help simplify things, that you can make sure that you actually meet that.
Yeah. And I would just say, I think every company has to evaluate the compliance process and the complexity and under their own risk appetite. Not every tax return is perfect. Everyone does their best to get it. There's no materiality. We all know that. But Pillar 2 is a new angle. It's a new animal. And you got to take a risk-based approach to every aspect of it in accordance with your company's risk appetite.
So last question here then, what advice do you have for taxpayers as they start thinking about their choice of calculation engine? So we talked a lot about choice of the different paths that taxpayers can go down from a data perspective, but what advice are you giving to taxpayers as they start thinking about calculation engines?
I think two or three key components. One, the ease of use. I've got enough change dealing with the data and the changing environment. I really want the system to be as easy to use as possible. This ties into the next point, which is ease of maintenance. Mm-hmm. The ever-changing rule set, the staggered country adoption, the ability to have multiple rules applied in different ways. I really wonder how many companies are really going to want to maintain all of that knowledge internally and that expertise internally. And even if I develop my own tool or I implement a tool inside my own environment, how do I maintain that on a go-forward basis? And then the last is, how can I integrate all of this exercise, all of this effort into my other processes? So does the tool integrate? Does it easily integrate into my compliance process? Can I get data in and out of it easily to integrate with my other processes? And how much visibility and security do I have in it? It's local calculation again. Do I want to be able to give every controller access to every country to do their local part of it? Or do I want to be able to really closely secure it so they only have information that they need?
All of that very much resonates with me, and particularly with the taxpayers that I've been talking to. But the one point that I will follow up is just how complicated this is. How complicated understanding the 36 countries that are implementing this year, what their differences are between the globe rules.
Yeah.
Between the initial model rules, the commentary, the administrative guidance, which countries can go retrospective. We've already seen two examples of jurisdictions that kind of accidentally implemented rules before they intended to do so and have had to change them and make public comments that they're going to change them. I think we're going to continue to see that. And I mean, I'm obviously leading that charge for our Pillar 2 engine globally, and it is challenging being able to identify what all those differences are, getting those programmed into the rules engine, and then to your point, maintaining that.
Yeah. And so, we've got tax experts in every
jurisdiction. Oh, yeah, that's our job.
Imagine if we didn't.
Right, absolutely. And so particularly for those taxpayers that are thinking about building themselves, even if they're in a limited number of countries, I would caution them that it is a challenging exercise.
It is. And it's also, to some extent, an iterative calculation that does not lend itself well to rows and columns of spreadsheets. It just doesn't. There are places in our practice and our business for spreadsheets. This is not one of them. It's just way too complex.
Oh, man. All right. Well, Anthony, this was a great discussion. Flew by. Yeah. Always enjoy talking to you.
Likewise.
How much you've helped educate me on this data process. And it's really been a pleasure working with you over the last couple of years.
Likewise, Dan.
So thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Cross-Border Tax Talks. Thank you, Anthony Ciara, PwC's Pillar 2 Data Strategy Global Leader. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Global Lead. Stay tuned for another exciting edition of the Cross-Border Tax Talks podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.